The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Patricia, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service, and for the next hour, I'll be reading to you from Time Magazine. Today's program is underwritten by G. Suggs Insurance. Please contact G. Suggs Insurance, your local independent agency, for trusted advice on home, auto, business, and life insurance. For more information, please visit gsuggsinsurance.com. That's gsuggsinsurance.com. Or call 919-875-8889. Today's issue of Time Magazine is dated June 21/June 28, 2021. It features the typical red border on the front cover with Time in large block letters in kind of a gray-green superimposed upon a brighter, more forest green background. In large block lettering, but not as large as Time, will never be the same, a Time 100 health special. And this is a bit of a clockwork orange collage. It's in a golden orange with various silhouettes of perhaps are cutouts or graphic designs, healthcare workers and patients in various poses in wheelchairs with hypodermic needles, with tongue depressors, with more wheelchairs, more vials of medication, more IV racks, microscopes, perhaps lecturers, people using microscopes, more IV bags hanging near a patient. And the first article to be read is under The View, titled The Leadership Brief. Inflation worries are keeping Larry Summers up at night, by Evan Shapiro. Former Secretary of the Treasury Larry Summers is featured here in a small inset photo, posed in a pensive mood with his right hand stabilizing his chin. He's looking askance from the camera lens. He has short, cropped gray hair, wearing a dark jacket and something of a bluish lavender or lavender blue shirt, open at the top button, background of gray-green. When a former Democratic Secretary of the U.S. Treasury raises alarm bells about the potential harmful consequences of the current president's economic policies, it raises home team hackles. Larry Summers, who served as Treasury Secretary under Bill Clinton and Director of the National Economic Council under President Obama, has emerged as a leading cautionary voice about how heavy government spending can trigger damaging levels of inflation. The Fed has had almost no success gently bringing down inflation once an economy has started to overheat, Summers said. In an interview May 28, the day President Joe Biden unveiled a $6 trillion budget, Summers, who's the Charles W. Eliot University professor at Harvard University and the while director of the Mozavar Romani Center for Business and Government at Harvard Kennedy School, joined Time for a conversation on the risks of inflation and speculative froth. What do you think the biggest threat facing the economy is right now, is a question postulated presumably by the Time reporter. Answer, the long run threat is that we will cease to be one effective country. Whether that is a failure of public investment in everything ranging from collecting the taxes that are owed, where there will be $7 trillion in taxes that are owed but not paid, over the next decade, that is a huge loss to the government and a huge source of injustice because most of the non-payment comes among the highest income Americans. Whether it is the fact that at an early stage we were dependent on other countries for masks and we were not well prepared for a pandemic, despite the fact that there had been repeated warnings that a next pandemic would come. Whether it's the fact that it takes half an hour longer on the schedule to fly from Boston to Washington than it did when I first started taking the trip regularly 40 years ago. This falling apart of society is our greatest long-term threat. And does the new budget address that? Is the question and the answer. I think that is what the president's program is trying to address in many powerful ways. I do think that it is also important, and it is important for the sustainability of the progressive enterprise, that it be managed in a macroeconomically prudent way. And I am concerned that we are injecting more demand into the economy than the potential supply of the economy is likely to work out to be. And that will generate overheating. That filling up the bathtub feels great, but if you don't stop it in time, the bathtub overflows, and it's much harder to clean up than it would have been to prevent. Question and the stock market? Answer. I'm also concerned about inflation and asset prices, where there's increasing evidence of speculative froth. In particular, markets like the SPAC, Special Purpose Acquisition Companies, market, and like the recent events in cryptocurrency. Question, can you expand on your view of cryptocurrency? Answer, look, the blockchain is a fundamentally important innovation that will be part of our economy for a long time to come. The particular cryptocurrency assets are highly speculative vehicles, enormously dependent on changes in sentiment. We have not seen the end, and we may not have seen the beginning of the end of their extraordinary volatility. Nobody should confuse them with any kind of bedrock of safety or as a central way in which to hold wealth. Any other concerns is the question, and the answer. I think another important part of the calculus is that when governments lose control over money, people tend to lose confidence in them. Progressives need to ponder the fact that when they're not able to keep inflation under control, they can pay a very large political price. Next to that article is a small column entitled, "The Popularity of Rescue Pets," under the heading History, and this was written by Olivia B. Waxman. More than 12 million U.S. households have gotten a pet since March 2020, according to the American Pet Products Association. But though shelters and rescues have gained popularity in recent years, their history in America is more than 150 years old. In 1869, Caroline Earle White and other women activists started what is considered the country's first animal shelter. In the Progressive Era, activists called for the humane treatment of animals, and after World War II, pets were seen as part of the quintessential suburban family. Times December 23, 1974 cover story on the American pet declared that pet ownership has become almost as sacred a democratic right as if it had been written into the Constitution. But as the number of breeders increased, so did the number of cats and dogs. And by the 1970s, animal welfare groups promoted sterilization to reduce the number of unwanted animals. More recently, social media is thought to have boosted awareness of adoptions. Experts believe the Biden's adoption of Major as first dog will help the cause, too. There is a small inset photo here of a woman with honey blonde hair. One sees only the back of her and the back of her hair, which is tied somehow with a green and white scarf. But over her shoulder, peering at the camera, is a little black floppy-eared puppy with little tiny white paws. And one doesn't notice if the puppy is smiling or not at the camera. But the caption reads, "Harold. who was adopted in Charleston, West Virginia, in January. A new hope for health care. The pandemic revealed the fissures in our current system. Now's our chance to mend them. And the illustration, which almost duplicates the one on the front cover, is credited to Eko Ojala, or Ojala, O-J-A-L-A, for Time. The article is written by S. E. Smith, How We Get Better. The healthcare system will improve only when we rethink who counts as an expert. Americans are emerging from the COVID-19 pandemic like survivors of a wildfire, surveying an unfamiliar landscape. As we take stock of what is left, we're forced to rebuild. But we need not simply restore what was taken in a hollow echo of what we knew before. We can make healthcare and the infrastructure that supports it better, stronger, more resilient. To do that, as we learned at great cost over the past 15 months, we must value all the stakeholders in the system, not just insurance executives and hospital CEOs, but patients, disabled people, older adults, low-income people, people of color who have faced historic healthcare discrimination, and healthcare workers and supporters, from home health aides to hospital registrars. Millions of Americans interact with the healthcare system every year, if and when they can afford it. But discussions about healthcare reform often leave out some of these voices. Policymakers, industry executives, hospital officials, and others in high-status positions hear from others in similar roles or from prominent members of the healthcare community, like sought-after specialists who bring in high-value patients. Underrepresented in these conversations are those who know the system at its worst, like ambulance crews making minimum wage, nurses in underfunded community health clinics, and uninsured patients who know what it is like to have their, that's H-A-L-V-E, their insulin dose to stretch to the next paycheck. The devaluation of these members of the healthcare community is paradoxically what makes their voices so important. Those who are considered lowest in status often have the best observations about the systems they are trapped in. Two groups of stakeholders were particularly vocal and active during the pandemic: nurses and disabled people. While communities banged pots and cheered, hospitals hung "Heroes Work Here" banners, and the media trumpeted about essential workers, many nurses were laboring in conditions that did not have to be so dangerous. Nurses are on the front line of patient care, on shift for hours with their assigned patients, unlike physicians, technicians, and other providers who typically see patients briefly for tests or assessments. Nursing work can be grinding and emotionally exhausting, and nurses often know their patients and their families best, seeing elements of the healthcare system that others may be oblivious to. Yet these medical professionals are often not afforded the respect given to doctors. During the pandemic, though, the nation had no choice but to hear the collective voice of nurses everywhere. Hospital by hospital, nurses worked together to make themselves and their patients safer, even if it meant wearing garbage bags as PPE, as some had to do in New York City, forcing those in charge to confront the reality that we were ill prepared for a national public health catastrophe. And as nurses rapidly adopted technology to allow for remote patient visits, too many of which ended with families saying goodbye via video chat, they reminded the healthcare community that patient care is not just about physical health. The disability community, including a broad swath of people from those with chronic illnesses to wheelchair users to mentally ill people, makes up roughly 26% of the population of the U.S. While the term professional patient is sometimes used in a derogatory way, it accurately describes many people who regularly interact with the healthcare system. They are, by nature of their healthcare needs, extremely familiar with the ins and outs of the system, including the problematic elements. During the pandemic, some organized around hashtags like #HighRiskCA, which was used to call out the way California's vaccine distribution system, in the first phase of rollout, left out disabled people who did not meet its 65-plus age requirement, but were highly vulnerable to COVID-19. Furthermore, through a partnership between the Johns Hopkins Disability Health Research Center and the Center for Dignity in Healthcare for People with Disabilities, a team that included disabled researchers set up a vaccine prioritization dashboard to track how states were handling disability eligibility for vaccines and help disabled people navigate incredibly confusing guidance. The disabled researchers drew upon their own experiences and fears in developing an accessible, clear product to help the community, filling a gap in the public health outreach system. We should not just cheer these examples as cases where some often overlooked people happen to offer something useful during a disaster. We should see them as a roadmap for the future. As we move forward, we should use the knowledge and skills of nurses, disabled people, healthcare coordinators, and myriad others to build the healthcare system we deserve. Those people need to be represented in the rooms where policies developed, including among legislatures, advocacy groups, and other entities that push policy priorities. People interested in healthcare reform should actively seek out these voices to learn more about how to advocate for what people actually need and to figure out what questions to ask those in power. When people raise issues that make advocates uncomfortable, it is necessary to lean into that discomfort and use it as an opportunity to do better. People with extensive experience in the healthcare landscape have critiques that may improve proposals to fix it. Consider the notion of a government-funded single-payer healthcare system. Many Americans, as much as 36% based on a 2020 Pew survey, say they support such a program, but the public conversation on this topic does not clearly define what such a plan would look like, and it's been muddled by conflicting proposals. Although people without experience in the healthcare space may think it is as simple as needing care and getting it paid for by the government, disabled people want answers to questions that to others might seem in the weeds, but are actually critical to everyone, such as how prescription benefits would be covered, or what happens when a costly test or procedure is recommended, but a patient does not meet strict criteria. We're emerging from a hard-fought war against an invisible enemy, and we know the current system's broken, but if we leave out the voices of people in the know when we fix it, whatever we develop may not be an improvement, but rather the same problems in a new package. As post-World War II Japan slowly began its economic recovery and manufacturing began to bloom, Toyota introduced the Andon cord, a literal cord that anyone on the production line could pull to pause production to address a safety or quality issue. The prospect of allowing anyone to bring a multi-million-dollar process to a halt may sound wild, but it turned out to be highly effective, making everyone into an experienced stakeholder, no matter the nature of the task they were performing. The Andon played a role in the culture turnaround of the NUMMI, NUMMI, auto manufacturing plant in Fremont, California, which had a toxic and unproductive work environment until the mid-1980s, when Toyota and GM began jointly operating it using Toyota's manufacturing processes. Empowering workers with the Andon proved successful in improving morale and increasing buy-in. The U.S. healthcare system as a whole needs a metaphorical Andon cord. It is something we know works in healthcare settings, as some facilities use similar safety checks to protect patients and providers, one of which is stop the line, which can be called by anyone. To stop and address a safety concern or other issue, such as the wrong medication or improper use of equipment. The point is, the real expert is not always the foreman or the team lead, the prestigious surgeon, or the person with the broad big picture view. Sometimes it's someone on the assembly line, or it's the hospital orderly who cleans rooms between patients. A physical plant worker can have a sharp idea for more safely sealing doors. An intern reading about right to repair laws can fight to get sidelined ventilators up and running. We may not know when the next pandemic will strike, but we do know that everyone needs health care, and the system needs to be much more robust the next time a new virus or mass casualty event happens. Repairing America's health care system requires the humility to recognize expertise no matter where it comes from, and the ability to integrate stakeholders into the process as early as possible. If we truly want everyone in the U.S. to have access to high-quality, safe, equitable, compassionate health care, we must stop to value everyone who's embedded in the system. The author of this article, S.E. Smith, is a National Magazine award-winning essayist and journalist. The sequencing solution, genetic surveillance, is the key to controlling future pandemics, by Ellis Park. You don't want to be a virus in Dr. David Ho's lab. That Ho is H-O. Pretty much every day since the COVID-19 pandemic began, Ho and his team have done nothing but find ways to stress SARS-CoV-2, the virus that causes the disease. His goal, pressure the virus relentlessly enough that it mutates to survive, to help drug developers understand how the virus might respond to new treatments. As a virologist with decades of experience learning about other obstinate virus, HIV, Ho knows just how to apply that mutation-generating stress. Whether by starving the virus, bathing it in antibodies that disrupt its ability to infect cells, or bombarding it with enough promising antiviral drug candidates to make it blink. We actually have more mutants of SARS-CoV-2 selected in the lab than I suspect most labs do, says Ho. As a result of that work, we have basically been seeing viral evolution happen in the front of our eyes for the past year and a half, he says. Ho, director of the Aaron Diamond AIDS Research Center at Columbia University, is among the vanguard of researchers aggressively finding ways to dismantle SARS-CoV-2 from the inside out by mining the virus's genetic code for signs of weakness. The viral genome, it turns out, is an underutilized pool of useful information about the virus's likes, dislikes, and survival strategies, all coded in the 30,000 base pairs that make up its genome. Ho, who built his career around finding ways to control HIV with drugs, once said of the disease, "It's the virus, stupid." Among the many lessons that will be taught in public health classrooms and in genetics labs around the country after the COVID-19 pandemic recedes is a corollary. It's the genetics, stupid. One of the most powerful ways of fighting a pandemic caused by a never-before-seen virus is decoding the microbial culprit's genome. Doing so can and should be the top priority of public health efforts going forward, so scientists can expose how the microbe works and learn in real time the best ways for controlling it and ultimately snuffing it out. Ho's group was among the first to identify a new mutation in SARS-CoV-2 that was responsible for a growing proportion of new infections diagnosed in New York City in February. He alerted city, state, and U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, CDC officials, as well as Dr. Anthony Fauci, the White House Chief Medical Advisor on COVID-19. He also added these sequences to the public database, GISAID, which stands for Global Initiative on Sharing All Influenza Data, reflecting its initial focus on flu, which collects disease-causing genetic codes from researchers around the world. When we looked at the database, we found these mutations were already there, Ho says. It is just that no one was scrutinizing or interrogating the database on a regular basis. That's already changing, and GISAID is becoming the digital watering hole for public health, infectious disease, and policymaking experts, as concerns about new variants and what they mean for immunity provided by vaccines dominate public health decisions about COVID-19. People are looking at the database differently from this point on, says Ho. That's also true of genomics more broadly. The COVID-19 pandemic is a hands-on workshop in how genetic information can help us more quickly control a pandemic. Relying on the SARS-CoV-2 code, first made public in January 2020, researchers at academic labs were ready to develop a diagnostic test for the virus within weeks, although regulators were slow to green light them. Teams at the National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Diseases and biotech company Moderna, as well as U.S.-based Pfizer and German biotech BioNTech, went to work to develop vaccines relying on the virus's genetic material called mRNA and set new speed records in coming up with formulas ready to test in people. In under a year, they stunned medical experts when they showed their shots were 94% and 95% efficacious, respectively, in protecting people from symptoms of COVID-19, becoming the first COVID-19 vaccines authorized by the U.S. Food and Drug Administration in December. Knowing the virus's genetic footprint, scientists at other pharmaceutical companies developed other types of vaccines as well as drugs to treat infection. And a year into the pandemic, the same viral genetic blueprint is helping researchers predict how different patients' immune systems will respond to infection and triage those who might be more prone to getting seriously ill so they can be treated more aggressively early on. It's also enabling experts like Ho to track deviations in the genetic code that might enable the virus to slip past these drugs and vaccines. Genomics and genomic epidemiology have emerged as an incredibly powerful tool in fighting this pandemic, says Francis D'Souza, CEO of Illumina, which makes the genetic sequencing machines that form the foundation of this field. And they will be essential to how we fight future biological threats, whether it's the next coronavirus or antimicrobial resistance or even bioterrorism. There's a small inset photo here of Dr. David Ho in New York City lab tests. It's his New York City lab where he tests how SARS-CoV-2 mutates in response to stress factors. Well, Dr. Ho's standing here dressed in probably a dark suit, although it could be a dark jacket with dark jeans, black shoes, a white shirt. He's wearing glasses. He has a crew cut, I would say. He's looking at the camera and smiling a bit, and behind him are all of the accoutrements of a lab, contraptions, machines with lids open and lids closed, and tables on wheels, and white lab coats hanging on hooks in the background, and shelves and cupboards, and it looks like a busy place. I'm going to skip ahead to the end of this incredibly long article and finish up with a few paragraphs. Private labs will play a role in expanding the breadth of the sequencing network. Last month, the CDC announced a partnership with North Carolina-based MAKO, or MAKO, M-A-K-O, Medical, to sequence about 5,000 positive samples of SARS-CoV-2 a week, taken randomly from MAKO's clientele of hospitals, long-term care facilities, pharmaceutical companies, workplaces, and public health labs in 43 states. With partners like MAKO, the CDC is ramping up its ability to sequence any positive samples from places like airports, since travelers are a common vector for introducing new variants of the virus into the country. That strategy is proving useful in the UK, where sequencing of positive samples from international travelers began in March 2021, with help from commercial labs. In some ways, the sequencing from airports is acting as an early radar system to find out what new variants are spreading around the world, says Dr. Gareth Williams, a co-founder and the medical director of Oncologia, one of the labs working on the project. How well other countries learn from the UK's efforts will likely shape the world's response to the inevitable next eruption of infectious disease. Embedding genomic techniques into the public health arsenal won't, on its own, prevent pandemics, but together with proven measures like hand hygiene, social distancing, and mask wearing, it could help contain them and minimize their toll on human health. We got pretty lucky that COVID-19 vaccines work as incredibly well as they do, says Sanford Burnham's Shanda. But we can't just rely on luck. We need to make a global commitment and come up with an organization that has some teeth and has some funding, whose job it is to survey, track, and share genetic information. We have the tools to do it. We just need the will and leadership, and especially the public, to demand the devastation of COVID-19 as something that should not have happened, and that we never want to have happen again. This article was written by Alice Park, with reporting by Madeline Roach and Simone Shaw. Here are two short columns that are companions to the larger article that I just abridged. Scientific breakthroughs we missed during the pandemic. While most eyes were on COVID-19, researchers have also made groundbreaking advancements in other fields. Here's a look, written by Jeffrey Kluger. The other big vaccine news: public health officials have long sought a vaccine against malaria, which infects up to 600 million people a year and kills 400,000, mostly children. This year, there was dramatic progress toward that goal. In a study of 450 children in Burkina Faso, published in The Lancet in April, researchers reported a new malaria vaccine called R21 is 77% effective, just clearing the World Health Organization's 75% efficacy standard. However, the sample group was comparatively small, and while the subjects were followed for 12 months, malaria is active in Burkina Faso for only about 6 months out of the year, making it unclear if the disease's half-year absence was partly responsible for the study's promising results. Investigators working for a multi-center international team, including the University of Oxford, plan to follow the initial sample group for at least another year and will conduct other trials in countries where malaria is active year-round, while also working to improve the shot so it triggers a more effective immune response. New face, new hands, new man. This is the second part of that column. In summer 2020, a team of 16 surgeons and 80 operating room staffers at NYU Langone Health performed the world's first successful, ready, face and double hand transplant, completing the procedure in just 23 hours. Speed is essential in transplant surgery because the sooner donor tissue is connected to the recipient's vascular system, the less time it's denied a blood supply. The recipient was 22-year-old Joe DeMeo of Clark, New Jersey, who suffered third-degree burns over 80% of his body in a 2018 car accident. His fingertips had to be amputated, and damage to his face was so extensive that he was left without lips or eyelids, even after 20 reconstructive surgeries. In 2019, DeMeo was listed as a possible transplant recipient. 10 months later, a suitable face and hands donor was located. Only two other face and hand transplants have been attempted. In the first, the recipient died of complications from the surgery. In the second, the hands had to be amputated because of infection. Advanced computer modeling helped the surgeons plan the latest transplant, and 3D cutting guides assisted in sawing and aligning bones, as well as properly positioning the plates used to attach the donor tissue. More than 9 months post-surgery, DeMeo continues to recover and thrive. Under the heading Public Health, we are entering a new era of innovation by Madhukar Pai, P-A-I, and Gavin Yamey, Y-A-M-E-Y. Pai is a physician and a Canada Research Chair of Epidemiology and Global Health at McGill University. Yamey is a physician and professor of global health and public policy at Duke University. There's a photo here. It looks like a clutter of small glass bottles. They're all labeled, and the labels seem to vary. And in fact, the sizes of the bottles seem to vary. And they're not all lined up, aligned, and stacked neatly. They're just dumped into some kind of a container. And the caption reads, "The rapid vaccine rollout shows how the pandemic changed healthcare." Despite recent gains made by countries like the U.S. and the U.K. in stymieing the COVID-19 pandemic, it continues to ravage most of the world. It also continues to revolutionize global healthcare in ways that could have lasting benefits. For example, the rapid development of safe, highly effective COVID-19 vaccines heralds a vaccine revolution. Researchers and pharmaceutical companies are already gearing the pioneering approaches of the COVID-19 vaccine makers toward vaccines for a range of other diseases, like HIV, tuberculosis, and malaria. COVID-19 also accelerated international science collaborations and sparked an unprecedented mobilization of research funds to develop new diagnostics, treatments, and vaccines. For the first time ever, COVID-19 prompted scientists as a whole to immediately share their research online with no paywalls as soon as their papers were ready. Obstacles remain. Manufacturing of new health technologies still takes place mostly in rich nations, with such technologies eventually trickling down to low-income nations. These advantages need to be more equitably distributed so that low- and middle-income countries become self-sufficient in producing their own health tools. The regulatory approval process worldwide needs to become faster and more streamlined. And we need to put a system in place to prevent rich nations from hoarding vaccines, diagnostics, and medicines in future pandemics. On another front, COVID-19 forced a global adoption of telemedicine. For example, one U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention study found a 50% increase in telehealth visits in the first 3 months of 2020 compared with the same period in 2019. Every single clinician we've spoken to, physicians, nurse practitioners, and nurses who have run telemedicine clinics during COVID-19 told us they want this shift to become permanent. Such visits are clearly not appropriate for every condition, says Zeynep Tufekci, associate professor at the University of North Carolina School of Information and Library Science. But when warranted, they can make it much easier for people to access medical health without worrying about transportation, childcare, or excessive time away from work. In low- and middle-income countries, telehealth has been used during the pandemic as a low-cost service to reach people in poor or remote areas. In India, right now, home-based care is the only realistic option for millions of people, as hospitals are overwhelmed. Another improvement to global public health that developed during the pandemic is in fighting scientific misinformation. Conspiracy theories, bogus remedies, and anti-science ideas abounded for the past 18 months, in part thanks to social media. The good news is scientists have responded with urgency and creativity. For example, new hubs like the University of Washington's Center for an Informed Public, the Taiwan Fact Check Center, and Britain's Science Media Center have emerged to specifically tackle misinformation. Despite such efforts, vaccine hesitancy is still a huge issue during this pandemic and will require redoubled efforts to fight misinformation. Alongside COVID-19, the year 2020 saw calls for racial justice and for the global health and development community to acknowledge their roots in colonialism and white supremacy. One ideal outcome here is that COVID-19 should push us to reimagining global health education, focusing more on equity and human rights, and integrating anti-racism and anti-oppression into our courses. This is in many ways an exemplar of the largest trend. COVID-19 has been the deadliest pandemic in 100 years, and the scars it leaves will endure. But the pandemic has also catalyzed innovations in science and healthcare delivery, forced us to turn back a tide of misinformation, pushed health higher on global and national agendas, and made us better teachers. Out of crisis comes opportunity. The overt operative, how an accused Kremlin agent worked with Rudy Giuliani in a plot to sway the 2020 election, by Simon Schuster, Kiev. This is a long article that I will abridge. This is under the heading World. The accused Kremlin agent was not hard to find. It took only a few days of pestering him for a meeting in early April before his answer arrived via encrypted message, beneath a profile picture of a lion showing its fangs. I tried very hard and found an opportunity. Andriy Derkach, and that's Derkach, wrote to me in Russian, adding politely, "If it's convenient for you." We set a time in Kiev the next day, but he declined to send an address. Instead, he dispatched one of his bodyguards to pick me up in a black van and drive in circles for a while, weaving through the gridlock of the Ukrainian capital before handing me off to two more bodyguards in the back of a luxury apartment tower. Through a side door and up a few flights of stairs was a space that could have housed a startup in Brooklyn or Silicon Valley, exposed brick painted in a shade of avocado, glass partitions, a foosball table, a black cat that eyed me from its nook in the waiting room. Only a few of the details aligned with my host's reputation. There were Orthodox icons crowding the shelves, and invisible speakers played a sound that barely registered like the distant chatter of a crowd, designed to jam unwanted listening devices. As we sat down in a conference room, Derkoch urged me to tape our conversation. "I'm already recording," he noted flatly, though it was not clear why or with what. In the world of espionage, it is rare to come across a spy with an office, a website, and a story to tell. It happens now and then, usually when the spy has retired and written a memoir. But active intelligence operatives, especially those with ties to Moscow, do not tend to speak on the record while pursuing their mission in the field. That's partly what makes Andrei Derkoch so perplexing. The U.S. government, under both Joe Biden and Donald Trump, has called Derkoch an active Russian agent. About a month before our meeting in Kyiv, that's K-Y-I-V, the Office of the Director of National Intelligence, which oversees all U.S. spy agencies, accused him of being a Kremlin operative par excellence, the tip of the spear in a Russian plot to sway the 2020 presidential election. In a declassified report, it said with high confidence, the gold standard for such conclusions, that Russian President Vladimir Putin had authorized and probably directed the plot to help Trump with a second term. As part of this operation, the report concluded, Putin had purview over the activities of Andrei Derkoch. Derkoch's efforts differed from Russia's more infamous round of election interference. During the 2016 presidential race, Russian military hackers stole and leaked emails from Hillary Clinton's campaign, hiding their work behind proxy servers and fake identities. Derkoch, a seven-term member of the Ukrainian parliament, worked in plain sight, often publicizing his efforts in the press as they unfolded. In the fall of 2019, he gained access to Trump's inner circle through Rudy Giuliani, the president's personal lawyer. He then provided Giuliani with documents purporting to show that Joe Biden and his family were involved in corruption. After their first meeting, Derkoch even posted a photo of himself with Giuliani on Facebook, mugging for the camera as they exchanged a stack of documents. In the months before Election Day, he released a series of secret recordings of Biden pressuring top Ukrainian officials to fight corruption. The source of those tapes remains a mystery to this day. The paradox of these maneuvers is that their brazenness helped shield Derkoch. If he was a spy, his associates told me, why would his work be so overt? Derkoch says the allegations of election interference are merely rumors and gossip, and he claims he went after the Biden family to expose corruption in Ukraine. At our meeting in Kyiv, I asked him several times about the U.S. assessment that he's a Russian operative, and he dodged the questions. Let's talk about your president instead. In the run-up to the election, the FBI and CIA both warned the Trump administration that Derkoch was advancing a Russian disinformation campaign. Trump and his allies nonetheless continued to amplify the narrative, initially on Twitter, Facebook, and cable news, and then roughly a month before Election Day from the stage of the first presidential debate. The online forums of QAnon, the cult-like movement of Trump obsessives, also promoted the Derkoch material. At one point, it appeared in posts from Q, their anonymous prophet. The plot served multiple interests. Derkoch could not have gotten through to American voters without the help from Trump and Giuliani, while the Trump campaign attacks against the Biden family relied in large part on the ammunition Derkoch provided. Whatever the truth of the U.S. allegations against Derkoch, Russia benefited from its efforts. Yuri Shavets, who served undercover as a KGB spy in Washington throughout the 1980s, says he was awed by the events as they played out. "They got inside the Americans' heads," Shavets, who studied the operation closely, told me by phone from his home outside D.C. Derkach's actions, he says, bear the hallmarks of Soviet and Russian tradecraft and succeeded in ways that most disinformation campaigns could only aspire to. "They would have been popping champagne over this back in Moscow," says Shavets. The operation showed that in the present age of American division, foreign influence campaigns need not be clandestine to achieve their goals. They only need to serve the interests of one side of the partisan divide. The plot also showed how hard it is for the U.S. to fight back. The costs of running this playbook have been manageable for Russia. A fresh set of U.S. sanctions that evoked hardly more than a shrug from Putin. As for Derkach, the fallout could be worse. The U.S. has not released any direct proof of its allegation that he's a Russian agent. But his activities are now reportedly the focus of a federal investigation in New York, according to a May 27 report in the New York Times. So far, however, the personal sanctions imposed against him for election interference in September 2020 have not been much of a deterrent. He's still at it, still offering up dirt on President Biden to any American who asks. This substantially abridged article was written by Simon Schuster, Kiev, with reporting by Mariah Espada, Barbara Maddox, and Simone Shaw. Next, the View essay. Can we escape the vaccine culture war? This is written by David French under the heading Nation. French is a Time columnist and the author of Divided We Fall. This is only a couple of pages long, but it may also be abridged for time constraints. Friday, March 19, my wife and I got in our cars to drive an hour south of our home in Franklin, Tennessee, a prosperous suburb of Nashville. The purpose of our trip was simple, to drive where it was easier and faster to schedule a COVID vaccination. In Franklin, it was hard. Demand was outstripping supply. Drive an hour south to more rural Tennessee, and it was easy. Supply outstripped demand. When we arrived, we were pleasantly surprised to see that the site was at least a little bit busy. The room was social distanced, but reasonably full. The atmosphere was pleasant and maybe even a little festive. The day many of us had long prayed for had arrived. Operation Warp Speed had worked. The end of the pandemic was near. Fast forward to Monday, April 5. That was the day for our second shot. Again, we got in our cars and drove south. We arrived at the same clinic, expecting to see the same sights, but except for my wife and me, the room was empty. Not a single other patient was there. When we talked to the nurse who gave us the shot, she told us there had been hundreds of no-shows for their appointments. After an initial burst of enthusiasm, attendance was tailing off. The vaccine hesitancy that polls predicted had arrived, and we were witnesses. Nothing about this should be surprising. After all, the history of the pandemics intertwined with the culture war. And from the beginning, the response to COVID has broadly split between blue and red, urban and rural, with virtually every important issue decided by your response to a single vital question, how dangerous is COVID-19? For all too many Americans, the answer to that question was almost entirely partisan, and the way they answered that partisan question dictated their response to the virus. January 22, 2020, Trump set the terms. He told CNBC the coronavirus was one person coming in from China. We have it under control. It is going to be just fine. No. Trump's single statement did not launch the COVID culture war, but it was the first spark in a blaze of disinformation that over time constructed the partisan alignment that followed. Red Americans disproportionately resisted COVID restrictions, while blue Americans largely embraced them. Taking their cues from Trump, conservative media elevated COVID skeptics. More progressive outlets raised COVID alarms. The result was entirely predictable. In March, a large-scale Gallup-Franklin-Templeton survey found Democrats tended to overestimate the risks of the virus and Republicans tended to underestimate its danger. The rest is deadly, polarized history. The nation ultimately constructed two competing coronavirus political cultures. Travel to a blue city during the height of the pandemic and the differences were clear. It was unthinkable to go maskless inside a retail establishment, and you would often endure glares and sharp comments even if you unmasked outside. In a red town, especially a rural red area, the reverse was true. It was almost unthinkable to wear a mask outside, and in some deep red areas, even wearing masks inside was frowned upon. Pastors who tried to implement masking and social distancing guidelines would sometimes face fierce resistance, though it was well established that crowded, close quarters in church could trigger super spreader events. It's presently almost impossible to depolarize the nation. We're deeply divided, increasingly live apart. As the Wall Street Journal vividly illustrated, from 1980 until 2020, the number of landslide counties, those where the presidential vote was 20 points more partisan than the national overall, went from 391 out of slightly more than 3,100 overall to an incredible 1,726, a clear majority. Well, we have run out of time for today's episode of Time Magazine. I hope you enjoyed it. Be sure to listen next time. I'm Patricia, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Today's program is underwritten by G. Suggs Insurance. Please contact G. Suggs Insurance, your local independent agency, for trusted advice on home, auto, business, and life insurance. For more information, please visit gsuggsinsurance.com or call 919-875-8889. Time Magazine's available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have comments or questions, call us at 919-832-5138. That's 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.